All right, so today we're going to be diving into some seriously fascinating stuff. We're taking a deep dive into Exodus chapters 3 and 4.
Okay.
The story of Moses and that burning bush.
Yeah.
We're going beyond the Sunday school version here
Right.
and uncovering some pretty mind-blowing insights about God, our own callings, and what it means to truly surrender.
Oh, yeah, these chapters are really the foundation for the rest of Exodus. You got the dramatic call of Moses, this incredible revelation of God as both holy and powerful,
Yeah.
and yet deeply involved in the lives of his people.
So let's start with Moses. We find him tending sheep near Mount Horeb. Not exactly the place you'd expect a major spiritual encounter, right? But that's where he sees the famous burning bush.
Right, but it's not just any burning bush. It's burning, yet it's not being consumed. What do you think that symbolizes?
I mean, I've roasted marshmallows over a fire, but never seen anything quite like that.
Think of it like this. God's presence is a purifying fire, something that refines but doesn't destroy. It immediately counters any fear that encountering God will be completely destructive.
Yeah.
It's actually good news, both for Moses and for us.
Okay, so God is intense,
Right.
but not out to obliterate us. I can get behind that.
Exactly. Then we get this incredibly personal moment. God calls to Moses by name.
Yeah.
Moses, Moses, just like he did with Abraham back in Genesis 22.
Right.
It really emphasizes how intimately God knows each of us.
And then God tells Moses to take off his sandals. It's just dirt, right? What's the big deal?
The ground itself becomes holy because the Holy One is there. It's a huge shift from the book of Genesis, where the focus was really on establishing God's trustworthiness.
Yeah.
Now it's about God's radical otherness, his complete separation from creation.
It's not about the dirt.
Right.
It's about God transforming even the most ordinary things into something sacred.
Precisely. And then comes the big reveal. Moses asks God's name and the answer,
Yeah.
I am. Now that's a name that leaves you wanting more.
It's kind of a vague answer, isn't it? Couldn't God have given Moses something a little more, I don't know, descriptive?
Well, that's the point. I am isn't a noun, it's a verb. It's continuous being, continuous existence. Unlike anything else in creation, it flies in the face of those old pagan ideas that gods could be controlled or manipulated. This is a God who is in charge.
So it's a bold statement of self-existence.
Yeah.
God simply is the source of all being.
Exactly. And that sets up a powerful contrast with the Pharaoh, who thought he was the I am in Egypt,
Right.
trying to control everyone and everything. But there's a bigger I am at play here.
That's when Moses starts raising objections, right? It's interesting how they reveal a lot about both Moses and God.
Absolutely. Moses gives us four main objections, each one rooted in insecurity.
Yeah.
But the way God responds gives us a beautiful glimpse into his character.
So let's break them down.
Okay.
Hit me with objection number one.
First up, who am I? It's classic, isn't it?
Yeah.
We all feel unqualified at times. But God's response isn't about Moses's resume or skill set.
Right.
It's about God's empowering presence.
Yeah.
The focus shifts from me to God with me.
So instead of look at what I can do, it's look at what God can do through me.
Exactly.
But wasn't Moses still unsure about God's identity at that point?
Exactly. That takes us to the second objection. When Moses asks, "Who are you?"
Right.
He isn't simply asking for a name. He's wrestling with God's true nature.
Yeah.
And once again, that I am response emphasizes God's eternal, unchanging essence. It's like God is saying, I am who I am,
Right.
and you can trust me even when you don't fully understand.
I feel like a lot of us ask that who are you question at different points in our lives.
Yeah.
So what's Moses's next concern?
This is where practicality kicks in. Moses says, they won't believe me. He's worried about his credibility. But God, being the awesome God he is, gives Moses some pretty convincing signs.
Okay.
The staff turning into a snake, leprosy appearing and disappearing. Talk about a show of power.
Whoa. So God was already backing up his words with action.
Absolutely. These signs demonstrate God's power over evil
Yeah.
and his ability to transform situations. Think about it. The snake,
Yeah.
often a representation of evil,
Right.
is controlled and rendered harmless by God.
Yeah.
Leprosy, a symbol of impurity and separation, is healed instantly, showing God's power to purify and restore.
Okay, that's powerful imagery. But what about Moses' final objection?
Ah, the classic I'm not eloquent excuse.
Yeah.
Basically, Moses claims he's a terrible public speaker.
Right.
And God's response, well, I created speech itself. I'll empower you to speak. Problem solved. Mm. God, the creator, the operator, and the ultimate speech coach.
That's amazing. So no matter our excuses, God is ready to equip us. But did Moses just like jump for joy and immediately accept this call?
That's where things get even more interesting.
So Moses has had this like mind-blowing encounter with God. The I am.
Yeah.
Who's given him this impossible task and some pretty wild promises. But did he just like drop everything and run off to Egypt?
You'd think so, right?
Yeah.
But the text doesn't dwell on any dramatic surrender scene. It's more matter of fact.
Okay.
Moses asks his father-in-law, Jethro.
Yeah.
If he can go.
Right.
Jethro says, okay.
Yeah.
And that's that.
That's kind of surprising. Yeah. No tears.
Yeah.
No wrestling with doubt.
Well, the focus here seems to be on obedience rather than feelings.
Okay.
Sometimes the most important step is simply doing what God asks, even if we don't have all the warm, fuzzy feelings yet.
But then, out of nowhere, things take a dark turn. God suddenly tries to kill Moses. What's going on there? It seems completely out of character with the compassionate God we've been learning about.
It's a shocking moment, for sure. But it's directly tied to circumcision and covenant faithfulness.
Okay.
Remember, Moses' son was uncircumcised,
right,
which is a sign of incomplete commitment to the covenant God made with Abraham.
Right.
Before Moses can lead others, God demands his own full surrender, symbolized by circumcision.
Wow. So it's like God saying, hold on, Moses, you're asking others to commit to me, but you haven't even fully committed yourself and your family.
Exactly. And it highlights how serious this covenant relationship really is.
Yeah.
God isn't playing around.
So Zipporah, Moses' wife, quickly circumcises their son.
Right.
And the danger passes.
Yeah.
Talk about a tense situation.
It's a stark reminder that God expects wholehearted obedience.
Yeah.
Especially from those who lead his people.
Okay.
And this event foreshadows a similar one later on when Joshua leads the Israelites into Canaan.
Right.
He also has them circumcised as a powerful act of recommitment to the covenant.
That's an interesting connection. Okay, so after that, like, dramatic near-death experience.
Yeah.
Moses and Aaron finally head back to Egypt.
Right.
They've got God's power behind them, this renewed sense of purpose. They tell the Israelites that Yahweh, the God of their ancestors, is going to free them from slavery. Right.
But how do the Israelites respond after all these years of oppression?
Well, what's remarkable is that the people believe them. Hmm. They see the signs Moses performs. They hear the message of hope.
Right.
And they respond with faith.
Wow.
A faith that had been kept alive through generations.
That's so encouraging. Even in the middle of suffering and oppression, God can spark hope and a belief in deliverance.
It's a powerful reminder that even when things seem hopeless, God is still working.
Yeah.
But this is just the beginning of the story.
Right.
The real drama unfolds when they confront Pharaoh, who, as you can imagine, isn't exactly eager to let his workforce walk away.
Yeah, I can't imagine Pharaoh being thrilled about this. Here's this guy, Moses, claiming that his God is more powerful than Pharaoh.
Right.
And the entire Egyptian system. Talk about a bruised ego.
Pharaoh's ego is about to get a major reality check. Remember, he sees himself as the ultimate power in Egypt.
Right.
The I am.
Yeah.
But he's about to learn that there's a much bigger I am in town. Okay, so Moses and Aaron walk right up to Pharaoh and deliver God's message.
Yeah.
Let my people go so they can worship me. But Pharaoh, being Pharaoh, isn't exactly receptive to this idea, is he?
Not at all. Pharaoh's response is basically, who is Yahweh that I should obey him?
Right.
I don't know him, and I'm certainly not letting Israel go.
Yeah.
It's a direct challenge to God's authority.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, I'm the boss here.
Right.
I make the rules.
That's a pretty bold statement. It's like he's picking a fight with a force he doesn't even understand.
Exactly. And Pharaoh's defiance sets the stage for one of the most dramatic showdowns in the Bible.
The plagues.
The plagues. Now things are getting really interesting.
Yeah.
But it's not just random chaos and destruction, right?
Right. Each plague is a targeted attack on a specific Egyptian god.
Okay.
It's God demonstrating his power over creation and exposing the impotence of the Egyptian pantheon.
Wow. So it's a systematic dismantling of their entire belief system.
Precisely. It all starts with the Nile, the lifeblood of Egypt, turning to blood.
Imagine the horror. This wasn't just a minor inconvenience.
Right.
The Nile was considered a god in Egypt.
Right.
The source of life and fertility.
Uh-huh.
So by turning it to blood, God showed his dominion over this supposedly powerful deity.
It's like God saying, you think your God controls the Nile, watch this.
Exactly.
But was that enough to convince Pharaoh?
Not even close. Then came the frogs.
The frogs.
Hordes of them. They were everywhere.
Oh my.
Invading homes.
No.
Kitchens.
Oh no.
Even bedrooms.
Okay, even I wouldn't want to deal with that. But I'm guessing there was a deeper meaning behind the frogs too.
Absolutely. The frog goddess, Hecate.
Right.
Was associated with fertility and childbirth. Mm-hmm. This plague mocked her supposed power.
Right.
It brought utter chaos to everyday life.
Yeah.
It's like God was saying, your gods can't even control a bunch of frogs.
So God was showing the Egyptians that their gods were powerless in the face of Yahweh. Did that make them reconsider their beliefs?
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Mm.
But Pharaoh remained stubborn. So God sent even more plagues. Gnats.
Rats.
Flies.
Yeah.
Pestilence that killed their livestock.
Oh.
Painful boils covering people and animals.
Oh, no.
Hail and fire raining down from the sky. Locusts devouring everything in sight.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely terrifying. I can't even imagine what it must have been like to live through that.
Each plague intensified the pressure on Pharaoh.
Right.
And
right.
Further exposed the powerlessness of the Egyptian gods.
Yeah.
And you have to wonder, at what point did the Egyptians start questioning their own beliefs, like, hey, maybe this Yahweh guy's the real deal.
You'd think all this chaos and destruction would convince Pharaoh to just let the Israelites go, but he seems determined to just hold on to power, what was going on in his mind.
It's a classic case of ego and pride getting in the way of common sense.
Yeah.
Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, even as his own people suffered.
So even after all that, Pharaoh still refused to budge. What happened next?
So Pharaoh's learned the hard way that the Egyptian gods, you know, are no match for Yahweh.
But even after all that, he still wouldn't let the Israelites go.
Yeah.
Talk about stubborn. What finally, like, broke him?
Well, God had one more plague in store. The most devastating one yet.
Okay.
The death of the firstborn.
Hmm.
Imagine the grief, the terror that swept through Egypt that night.
That's heavy stuff. Every family, from Pharaoh's palace to the humblest home, lost their firstborn son. It seems almost, I don't know, unthinkable.
It was a blow that struck at the very heart of Egyptian society.
Yeah.
The firstborn son was the heir, the future.
Right.
The one who carried on the family name and legacy.
Right.
This plague demonstrated without a doubt that Yahweh was in control.
Yeah.
Even over life and death.
And it sounds like a complete reversal of everything the Egyptians believed.
Right.
Their gods couldn't protect them.
Yeah.
But this unknown god, Yahweh, had the ultimate power.
Exactly. And this final plague also highlights a crucial contrast. The Passover lamb.
Okay.
God instructed the Israelites to sacrifice a lamb and mark their doorposts with his blood. This act of obedience spared their firstborn sons from the angel of death.
So the Passover lamb was like a shield protecting the Israelites from God's judgment.
Right.
But wasn't there a deeper meaning to this too?
Absolutely. The Passover lamb symbolizes sacrifice and redemption.
Okay.
It points forward to Jesus, whom Christians believe is the ultimate sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
Whose blood would atone for the sins of all humanity.
Wow, that's a powerful connection.
Right.
The events of Exodus foreshadow this central message of the Christian faith.
Right. It draws a clear line between those who trust in Yahweh.
Yeah.
And those who cling to their own power and defiance.
So finally, after all the death and destruction, after his own son was taken.
Yeah.
Pharaoh finally broke. He begged Moses to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. And they left, didn't they?
They did.
With all their possessions and even like some Egyptian gold and silver.
It was the moment of liberation, the culmination of everything that had led up to this point.
Well,
this wasn't just about escaping slavery. It was about the triumph of Yahweh's power over human arrogance and a testament to his faithfulness, to his promises.
You'd think that would be the end of the story, a happy ending.
Right.
But their journey wasn't over yet, was it? They still had to cross the wilderness to reach the promised land.
It's important to remember that this was just the first step in a much larger journey.
Yeah.
Leaving Egypt was one thing.
Right.
But now they had to face the challenges of survival in the wilderness. A place that would truly test their faith and resilience. Think of it as like wilderness survival 101.
Okay.
With God as the instructor.
I like that analogy. But their first major obstacle was, I mean, pretty daunting. The Red Sea, trapped between the sea and Pharaoh's army, it must have felt like the end of the line.
It seemed impossible, didn't it? But But this is where we see one of the most famous miracles in the Bible.
Okay.
God parting the Red Sea.
Yeah.
Imagine that scene.
Mm-hmm.
The wind howling, the waters dividing, the Israelites walking through on dry ground. Talk about a spectacle.
It sounds like something straight out of a Hollywood movie. That must have been an incredible moment for the Israelites to, like, witness God's power firsthand.
Absolutely. It was a clear demonstration that God was with them, fighting for them.
Wow.
But Pharaoh, still not learning his lesson, tried to follow with his army.
You're kidding. After everything they'd seen, they still thought they could defeat Yahweh. What happened?
Well, let's just say things didn't end well for Pharaoh and his chariots.
Right.
When the Israelites were safely across, the waters rushed back in.
Oh, wow.
Swallowing up the entire Egyptian army.
Wow, that's a powerful image. The Red Sea incident wasn't just about escape.
Right.
It was about, like, complete victory. A decisive judgment on the Egyptians for their arrogance and refusal to acknowledge Yahweh.
You got it. The destruction of Pharaoh's army was the ultimate sign that the old order was gone. A new era had begun, an era where Yahweh reigned supreme.
So the Israelites were safe.
Right.
For now. They had witnessed miracles, faced impossible odds, and emerged victorious. But their journey wasn't over yet.
Right.
They still had the wilderness to cross, and I imagine that came with its own set of, you know, challenges.
You're right.
Yeah.
The wilderness was a harsh place full of dangers and unknowns.
Right.
But it was also a place of incredible spiritual growth.
Mm.
This is where they learned to rely on God, to trust him, even when things were tough.
Yeah. So they traded one set of challenges for another, slavery in Egypt versus surviving the wilderness.
Yeah.
But at least they had God on their side this time.
That's the key takeaway, isn't
it? Yeah.
Freedom wasn't just about leaving Egypt. It was about entering into a deeper relationship with Yahweh.
Hmm.
It was about learning to trust him.
Right.
To follow his guidance.
Yeah.
To let him provide for them.
So even in the midst of hardship, the Israelites were experiencing God's grace and faithfulness. They were being shaped into a people who reflected his character and lived according to his covenant.
Exactly. And that journey through the wilderness speaks to us today, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We all face wilderness experiences in our lives,
right.
Times of uncertainty, loss, and challenge.
It's encouraging to know that we're not alone in those times.
Right.
God was with the Israelites in the wilderness, and he's with us in our own struggles.
And just like he provided for them,
he
promises to provide for us.
Okay.
He guides us, protects us, and reveals his presence in ways we might not always expect.
Yeah.
These chapters in Exodus remind us that even when we can't see the way forward,
right.
God does. He's leading us to our own promised land.
So what does all this mean for us as we, like, wrap up our deep dive into Exodus chapters 3 and 4?
I think the key takeaway is this. God calls each of us by name, just as he called Moses.
Right.
He invites us to participate in his story, to be a part of his plan for the world.
But like Moses, we're going to have our own objections, fears, and insecurities, right? Will we be brave enough to say yes, even when it feels, I don't know, impossible?
Absolutely. We're all a work in progress, right?
Yeah.
But God is infinitely patient and compassionate.
Yeah.
He meets us right where we are and gently guides us forward.
Yeah.
He equips us for whatever he calls us to do, just like he did with Moses.
So if God were to call your name today, what objections would you raise and how would he respond? It's a question worth pondering because the same God who called Moses is calling us.
Right.
He's the I Am, present, powerful, and personally involved in our lives.
Yeah.
And he's waiting for our answer.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Exodus. May you experience the presence and power of the I Am in your own life today.